Alan Crane Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2022.
Today, yield curves and forward interest rates. Before we do that, have a quick look at the numbers and see what's going on in the markets right now. The obvious question is always, is it a good day or a bad day on the street? Bull day or a bear day? It's a hard bull day. This is a very strong up bull day. You got all the indexes up nearly 2%. They're just walking all over this. And of course, I'm losing insane amounts of money right now because I'm in a bear's position, hoping for the apocalypse, and all of a sudden we decide that we're going to have a great day out there. And as you can see, it's broad-based. This is a broad-based rally, and it's just been going up and up. It paused a little earlier in the afternoon, but then it just turned on the steam, and now it's just roaring upward. And boy, am I getting killed. Crude oil has found its way back above 80. That band 82 to 89, it had breached that hard on the downside, and now it's back up to 82 and a couple of cents. I wouldn't be too worried about the price of gasoline right now. It's still going to remain fairly low for the time being. I mean, we're way below where we were a couple of months ago. So, I mean, it's not like the end of the world is coming because oil is at 82 a barrel on the Brent. But going over here real quick, just to have a quick look, gold and silver are both up too. So we've got equities. Money's going into equities, money is going into commodities, and the bonds, yields are dropping, so the bonds are going up. So there is money pouring in all over the place here in the markets in the United States. The equities, money's going in, commodities, money's going in, bonds, money is going in. It's just a grand, stupid, bull day. And oddly, though, the Nikkei dropped hard. And then it just kind of flattened out. There was bad news that set it off in the morning over in Tokyo, and then from there it just didn't do anything from there. Now London started out, once the sun had set in Tokyo, London opened up, and it started out very bearish. And then by the end, the bulls had started to run there, and as the sun set there, came up on the United States, and the bulls just kept on rolling. So this is like a global thing. At least Asia doesn't seem to be happy, but the rest of the world seems to be in a really bullish mood right now, which is kind of odd. I don't know what it is, but well, like I said, the underlying strength of the economy is there. And there is good reason to believe that by the beginning of next year, we're going to have a solid recovery underway. So there's that. Now I'm going to go over here. Now, as you can see, bond yields are going down, which means that bond prices are going up. So yields are falling. Now, if I look over here at the, I wish they would let me bookmark this, and I can't get them to do it. Let me do this real quick. We'll look over here at what the Treasury yields are doing. And that's right here. If we look here, you see that even though that short term, see how it shaved off a basis point on the yield? that was what you were seeing yesterday going on, and now it's continuing today. See how the yields are dropping through the day today? And you can see that over here. See how these yields are sliding backward? Interestingly enough, the opposite is happening on the long end of the yield curve. Now, that doesn't sound good, but that actually is very good news. We have had something called an inverted yield curve, and it has been persistent and large and wide scale. And, I mean, that's a sign of a recession coming. Look up here, for example. See how this rate was above the rate on the one right before it? And then you had drops. That's an inverted yield curve. That's an awful thing. That means almost every time we've seen that historically, a recession has followed it. But now, with the, see how that's trying to get itself right. It's not right yet. You see how it's still inverted right in there? See that inversion? Right through there? Right in there. There's still an inversion, but it's those numbers are recovering. So in other words, the yield curve is getting itself straightened back up the way it should look, and that's good news. Now let's do something. Let me do something here real for a little bit here. I'm going to go do a little bit of history. But the first thing that I want to do is to rewrite that equation on the board, that an interest rate with a marker that works. Really? You could bring one. You know, if...
I'll bring some. I honestly will. I promise you.
What the hell are you eating? Oh, no. Those are those flaming hot ones. Yeah. They give me the wind. An interest rate is the risk-free rate plus the risk premium. Now, the risk-free rate has those two pieces, the real rate and the expected inflation premium. And then the risk premium is the default premium plus the maturity premium plus the illiquidity premium. Now, those are in different sizes for whatever interest rate you want to talk about. That's why we have interest rates that are different for different instruments. Now, the real rate is the one that is the supply and demand for money, the one that the Fed tries to control through several mechanisms available to it. But the bottom line is, and I'll talk more about how the Fed does that in a lecture later, but the supply of money, what the Fed will do is there will be a fixed amount of money in the economy on a given day, and that will establish the equilibrium of supply, quantity supplied and quantity demanded. If the Fed, as it did during the last from 2017 to 2022, they were printing money at a very strong rate, increasing the supply, lowering the real interest rate, which of course brought the risk-free rate down because the expected inflation premium wasn't moving very much. But then the expected inflation premium began to embed itself and start accelerating upward. And so the risk-free rate started going in the direction the Fed didn't want it to. The Fed wanted to bring it down by dropping R sub real, but then the expected inflation premium started to sneak in there and build, and that pushed the risk-free rate back up. We started getting expected inflation because we were getting actual inflation. And the markets were saying, okay, we expect more of it, so we're going to price forward and put higher and higher prices into our products. As you all see, right now in the economy. So then the Fed found the Lord and started cranking it back, whacking it this way, dropping the money supply. Oops. And of course, that shot interest rates back up. And the expected inflation premium was still going up, and the real rate started going up, and so now we have interest rates going really high right now. I mean, seriously, higher than they have been for some years. It was spoiling us what was going on. But that's what we'll have to do, and eventually the markets will say, okay, we believe you, and they'll start getting rid of this. The expected inflation premium will begin to drop, and we'll see the risk-free rate begin to let up, and then ultimately the Fed will release the money supply and allow it to come back out a little bit. So that's where it's going. Eventually, within maybe about 6 months to a year, we'll begin to see interest rates ease back off for a to more tolerable levels. But the impact on this is clear. Let me show you a silly little example. Suppose that a bank can, suppose that a company can borrow capital funds at, let's say, 6%. That's the prevailing rate for a company that has a certain risk level. They can get capital, issue bonds at 6%. Now, suppose that that company has three projects. And here are here's the ROI of each project, Project A, Project B, and Project C. Suppose that Project A comes in with an ROI of 7%. Project B comes in with an ROI of 9%, and Project C comes in with an ROI of 14%. Now, if the cost of capital is 7%, or is 6%, and you can pull, the cost of capital is 6%. This company is going to take all three projects. Even the one at 7%, the cost of capital is less than what the project is providing. So you're going to say, yes, we go with it. Now suppose that the cost of capital goes to 8%. Well, they're going to say no to Project A because it costs 8% to get 7%. The company's going to say no to that. So in other words, that project is going to be a no, so the employment that project created is not going to happen, the profits from that project are not going to happen, and all of that. Now suppose that that the cost of capital rises to 10%. Well, obviously you're not going to take A because it gives you only 7% back. You're going to say no to Project B because it gives only 9% back for money that cost. Excuse me, for capital that costs you 10%. So you're going to say no. The only one you're going to take is the 14% project. That means even less new employment. That means even fewer profits, lower profits. And there's an even worse part to this. So you see what interest rates do. That's how they throw us into recessions, because fewer and fewer projects are a go because the cost of capital is going up. If the risk-free rate goes from 1% to 2% to 3%, that's what's going to bump all interest rates up, because they're all underneath them all is the risk-free rate. But there's another nasty thing going on here, a hidden thing. You see, the lower the return on a project, most likely the lower the risk of the project. That's the whole relationship. The lower the risk, the lower the expected return. So Project A was a low-risk project. Project B was a medium-risk project. Project C was a high-risk project. Do you see how as interest rates go up, companies have a natural tendency to abandon safer projects and go for the long ball project, what we used to call in football the Hail Mary, pass down to the end of the field? In other words, companies are being pushed towards the projects that are the most likely not to succeed. So in other words, these interest rates going up have a secondary effect of causing more companies to fail because they have to take on risky projects to cover the cost of the capital, and risky projects have a higher risk of failing. And so you'll see bankruptcies go up and companies contracting and all of that as interest rates rise. That's just a natural tendency. Look at a company like, for example, I suppose some of you are familiar with a company like Macy's or Bed Bath & Beyond. They keep going through rounds of closing stores. Why are they doing that? Because stores that were okay to run, they didn't have a lot of sales, but they were still okay. You made some money off them. Now that interest rates are going up, those stores are no longer viable because the company has to take only the stores that have the highest impact sales-wise. The same is true with companies that would have in the past had a number of projects on their table. Some of them would not have yielded a whole lot of ROI, but they were still good. But in a high interest rate environment, the company can't keep those projects anymore. They just cannot keep them. An example of that is Ford. Ford has now decided that it is no longer going to produce any cars except for Mustangs and focus only on its high margin, big ass trucks. And it's clear, you see all those cars they used to do, like the Taurus and the cars like that, they just don't have enough impact ROI to be viable in a high interest rate environment. And what's worse is, once you shut down those factories, it's going to take a long time if you ever reopen them. So this has a long tail effect, these high interest rates do. Even though they won't last, and I can promise you, you can come back to me in a year and you'll tell me, yes, I see interest rates are beginning to ease back up. This is not some mystical or magical thing. It's not a political thing. It's just the mechanics of it. And yeah, when interest rates go up, you're going to have plant closures. You're going to have projects that were being considered getting abandoned. And you're going to have more companies going into bankruptcy because even their best projects are now the only ones they are taking on are risky. And those risks can kick the ass of a company. And that's just the reality of it. So hold on for the ride. This is how recessions occur. And just as the truth of the matter, though, recessions in the United States, back before active government policy, they lasted for years and years, in several cases, decades. And in the current era, in your lifetime, since the 1930s, the recession lengths have shortened quite a bit. So the pain is there, but it doesn't last nearly as long as it would have in the 1800s or in the early 1900s. Hell, before we have good data, we're pretty sure there were recessions that lasted a century, for heaven's sakes. But now that the government actively tries to manage it, they aren't as long, and sometimes they can be pretty severe, but a lot of that has to do with when the Fed loses the ball, and I will talk about that in a subsequent lecture. But you can see higher interest rates cause problems for us all. Now, let me go back here and review just to make sure you understand the default premium. A bank, and I use a bank as an example, a bank is going to require a somewhat higher rate on its loans because some of its borrowers are going to default. So they're going to put some scratch onto it. How much? It depends upon the risk of the borrower. For lower risk borrowers, they will still issue them. The interest rates are the one that we usually watch for banks. There's a rate called the prime rate. It's sort of the rate, it's the rate that banks are charging their highest credit worthy customers. And then some banks actually stack their other interest rates on their prime rate. So in other words, if you're a large credit worthy corporation, you would get a lower rate than say a smaller, say, company or a startup. In my case, in my company, I am paying a rate that is probably about 300 basis points above what that bank would charge to one of its big companies that it lends money to. The same is true in bond markets. Investors in bonds, that's a fancy way of saying the lenders to the company. A company issues $50 million in 30-year bonds. The coupon rate is going to be driven by the credit rating of that company, of that company that's borrowing the money. The credit ratings are set by three agencies, and you don't need to write this down now, but there's Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch, and they give a series of letters, and those designate the credit worthiness of the corporation. And the better those letters are, the lower the coupon is that the investors are going to require the company to pay. So a AAA, under Standard & Poor's rating, company would have a coupon of, let's say, 4.5%. In other words, its lenders want 4.5% every year. A company with, say, a single A rating would have to pay a coupon that might be 6%. And a company in the B's or the C's, junk, would be issuing what we call junk bonds. More politically correct, we call them high yield bonds, because those coupons are going to be way up there, 9, 10, 12%. Interestingly, Netflix had borrowed so much money that they were considered rather risky. So when they went out to borrow this massive amount of money at $1.2 billion or something like that, some insane amount of money, the credit rating of that was junk, and the coupon that they are paying on that is pretty darn steep. And this is a big company, Netflix. Why is it risky? Because it's already borrowed so much money that its interest expense is getting up there close to what they have in operating income to pay their interest expense. So in other words, at times interest earned, if it gets too close to one, operating income divided by interest expense, that company is going to pay a very high coupon on any money that it borrows. That's Netflix. And there are other companies that have gotten themselves into that situation too. Arsabam. This is the one that's a little bit odd when you think about it. Okay. Let me think here. You, sir, you have borrowed on a mortgage. Currently, it's about 6.5%, okay? So now, I'm the lender. I've lent you 30-year money, 30-year capital at 6.5%. Now, that means that for 30 years, I'm expecting to get a return of 6.5% per year. Now, suppose interest rates go down, let's say to 4%. What are you going to do? You're going to refi. You're going to see that, in other words, he's going to find a bank, borrow the money from that bank, and then give me back my money. I expected to get 6.5% for 30 years. I'm going to get it back, and all I can lend it out at is 4%. So I have downside risk. And the longer that mortgage is, the more likely it is that it's going to hit that, trigger you to refi. Now let's talk about the other side of it. Did you know that the average homeowner keeps a house for about 7 years? The average homeowner? About 7 years. Yeah. So in other words, let's say that you got that 6.5% loan and interest rates on mortgages go up to 10% in about 7 years. Are you going to sell your home and get another one with a mortgage? No. Even though in that time period, your family has grown from two people, now your brother-in-law is living there, you've got six kids, and you've got your brother and his friends who are running some kind of operation out of the garage where they come out wearing gas masks, you are going to keep that home because you can't afford to change homes. So in other words, if interest rates go up, I was expecting you to get that money back to me so I could lend it back out at 10%. You're not going to do that. So I am caught on the upside. So in other words, as time goes on, there's greater and greater chance at longer and longer maturities that interest rates are going to go down or they're going to go up. So the maturity premium is put in there, and it's bigger the longer the loan is. Because as the loan length goes up, there is a higher chance that I, the banker, will get burned on the downside or the upside. That's why when you take out a loan for a mortgage, you'll get a better rate on a 20-year loan than you will on a 30-year loan. It's purely that mortgage, maturity premium is bigger the longer the loan is. That's why you'll get a loan that is, I just got an advertisement from a Mitsubishi dealer. You finance today for 3 years, and you'll get 2.99% APR. And I'm thinking, kiss my ass, that would be ridiculous. On a $40,000 car, I can't afford those payments. But they'll offer really attractive deals on lower term on loans of shorter length. That's the maturity premium. It's lower the shorter the loan. Higher the longer the loan. So if you can possibly do it, it does save you a noticeable amount of money doing a financing for 25 or 20 years than what it does for a loan that is 30 years. And that goes for cars too. Some people say, well, I'll get my payments lower by taking a 72-month loan out. Yeah, well, your interest rate is going to be ridiculously higher than if you had taken out one for 60 months or 48 months. Yes, your payments will be higher, but you'll dump the loan faster and you won't pay as much total interest if you take the shorter loan. It's a trade-off. You have to decide where you are. The maturity premium is going to burn you. That's why it is so weird when we see the yield curve inverted. Because a yield curve, a healthy yield curve, should look like this. As the term of the maturity time increases, the interest rate, the yield to maturity, as we call it, and I'll talk about this in bonds chapter, should go up. That's a healthy yield curve. It should look like that. Let me show you back in 2021. See how pretty it was? That's a normal yield curve. See how it arches upward? Just a nice arch upward. That's a healthy yield curve. By the time we get to, let me do 2022. Let me get to this was what I was having a cow about in spring semester. I was looking at this yield curve. Where was it that it started to turn really nasty on us? Oh, yeah, it was a little bit later. You see how it went flat there, and then it dropped? That's an inverted yield curve. In other words, it dipped and then came back up. That means, historically, every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. Every recession. Now, sometimes the curve has inverted, and all we've gotten is an economic pause, two times. But almost always, an inverted yield curve is a signal of a recession, 6 months, 3 to 9 months out. And sure enough, it was inverting like a boss. Do you see it? Look at that. What was bad was it got worse. It wasn't just one spot where it dipped. It started going long, dropping down. You can even see here, God, by the time we got to here, it was nosediving. Look at that thing. And it's funny, too, because it was only a month after the first inversion that you saw even anything in the financial news about, well, maybe a recession is coming. And then just recently, they started peeing themselves about an inverted yield curve. Dude, this thing has been inverted for quite a while. And so, guess what? We're in a recession. No, we're not near a recession. We are actually in a recession. Don't let the politicians tell you anything else. But it's not a horrible one, but it's a recession. So anyway, now, look. Do you see how we still have the inversion, but it's not quite as long as it was? That means that it's recovering. We're coming out now. So that means that, yes, we're in a recession. Look down the road about three to 6 months, and we'll be in the recovery, in a strong recovery, as long as this keeps righting itself. But that means that the Fed has to hold the line and get those interest rates back down. To get them back down, it has to drain the expectation of inflation out of business decision making, and then it can loosen up the money supply again, and we get our real interest rate down, the risk-free rate goes down, and we're back in business again. Even the default premium will go down once businesses get themselves back in normal operating territory. The default premium will begin to slip a little bit too. Because you won't have as many companies going into bankruptcy. But for now, we're in the dark time of this economic cycle. Okay, what's the next thing that goes on from this? A couple of directions that I can take you. Oh, I do want to show you something. If I can remember where this place is. Let me show you. There's a site, and I want to find this one. It's really... There it is. This is stockcharts.com, and they've got a dynamic yield curve. No, quit that. Get off. There we go. Let me take you. Here's where we are right now. See the red? Really? No, it's actually a moving picture, but they've got Java disabled, so I can't make it move. Just irritates the hell out of me. Really? That's such a useful thing. See, you can actually say, what did it look like a year ago? And you can move it toward the present right here, and you can see how the yield curve is moving. And this is not doing that for me, which just, oh well. It was worth a try to show you something interesting, but anyway. So, come on, can't we have, is it that hard to have a bear market so I can get out with my skin? Just irritates the hell out of me. Yep, I'm losing my butt today. Anyway, okay, take you a little further here. There are a couple of things that I want to show you. But the first thing is that just a brief review of the history of the of this, and it starts well before your time, in an era when tax rates, the highest marginal tax rate was 70%. We had presidents starting with about Dwight Eisenhower. he was a fiscal conservative, pretty much a moderate as far as social things go. But he would say no, he allowed his Republican Congress, when he took office, to pass a tax cut. But then he said no to tax cuts after that. And he also said no to emerging progressive policies. And he just said no to all of this. He said the government should have a limited role, and we had almost, balanced budgets. The government didn't spend much money, and it taxed at a fairly stiff rate, and everything was fine. But then we came to the 1960s, and we had a much more liberal, progressive president, John Kennedy, who took on the war in Vietnam. He was anti-communist as hell. He came out of World War II, and he hated communists. But he wanted a lot of things spent money on. He spent money to fight the communists that were running around in Southeast Asia, and he also started spending money on social programs. He said, we're going to have a war against communism overseas, and we're going to have a war against poverty here in the United States. And he got all this underway, and he said something that was rather shocking. In 1961, he said, we are going to put a man on the moon by the end of this decade. And of course, all the engineers and scientists said, yeah, sure we are. You're not kidding? What the hell? And we did that too. We beat the Russians to the moon and all that kind of good stuff. Money being spent hand over fist. Well, Johnson took over when Jack Kennedy was assassinated, and Johnson pushed the programs even more. Even though Johnson was, by his nature, an old conservative blue dog Democrat, he kept pushing because Jack wanted it. And then Nixon won in 1968, and we went to more conservative policies, although the idea that Nixon was a social conservative is actually not quite true. He was the one who appointed the Supreme Court justices that created the most liberal court in the nation's history. He also was the president overseeing the passing of the Environmental Protection Act, the first thing of its kind ever. But we got into a spat with the Arabs, and they shut off the oil in 1973, the OPEC oil embargo. The price of oil just skyrocketed. Gasoline lines, they were just insane. Anger and all that. And Nixon, one of the things that he got the Fed to do was to print money to monetize the price shock, supply of money going out, to try to put money in people's pockets to shut them up and to keep interest rates from going popping through the roof. Unfortunately, the Fed didn't stop. It just kept printing more money because expected inflation would go up, so the Fed would print money to drop the real interest rate. Expected inflation would get worse, so the Fed would print money to bring it back down, and it turned into a vicious cycle. Nixon resigned in 1974, and his vice president, Gerald Ford, took over. And Ford, bless his heart, he was a really nice guy, but he just didn't have the strength and the will to get the Fed oriented toward cutting. Instead, he had a million buttons printed that said, whip inflation now, win. He thought that if people just decided they wouldn't have inflation, that would stop it. Well, of course, that was ridiculous. And he was voted out of office in 1976, and a gentleman named Jimmy Carter was put in. Now, he was just a simple peanut farmer, but he also had an advanced degree in nuclear physics. He understood. But the first thing he tried was a Ford trick. He said he saw inflation as the moral equivalent of war, unfortunately with the acronym MEOW. Well, that didn't work, and of course, Carter wasn't stupid. He knew what had to be done. He appointed a Federal Reserve chairman named Paul Volcker that just cracked the whip. He crushed the money supply. And of course, all the markets said, yeah, we've heard that before. Fed's getting tough, blah, blah, blah. expected inflation just kept going up, and old Volcker held on. And eventually, Volcker got all the financial markets, eventually, to answer the burning question, who's your daddy? Okay, do you believe me now? No, do you believe me now? As Volcker put his hand on the throat of the money supply. And finally, it buckled. But of course, to do that, expected inflation was already raging. And when he cut the money supply, the real interest rate just went through the roof. And we went into a stagflation, stagnating economy, inflation. And Carter was kicked out of office in 80 in favor of a former governor of California and actor in Western movies and cigarette commercials named Ronald Reagan. And of course, by that time, the expected inflation was beginning to drain, and Reagan's Congress passed a massive tax cut that stimulated the economy, and then we came out. Volcker began to let up on the money supply. And we went into a recovery that was pretty nice. So there you are. This is the history of what happens. This Fed is doing it much more quickly than the Feds of the 1970s did it. It was only after years of building expected inflation that the Federal Reserves of the 1970s finally got around to crushing the money supply. This time, they're not doing it in a matter of years, they're doing it in a matter of months, as you can see from that chart that I showed you there. Yeah, I've already killed it, so of course I can't show it to you. But that's where we are now. It will get better, and it will get better faster, but that doesn't mean there's not going to be pain, and that does not mean that most people in this country are going to understand. They don't, they can't. That's why we lead. We give them their bread and their circuses. We tell them our stories and our conspiracy theories and our promises. But behind the scenes, we take care of the ship of state the way it's supposed to be by trained, educated people. That's your job. Welcome to the masters of the universe. Anyway, okay. Now, let me take you on here. I just showed you a way to see a crystal ball. You look at the yield curve, and you can see kind of fairly well what's going to be coming within the next 3 to 9 months. So we are not completely in the dark about the future. That doesn't mean we can predict it perfectly. Hell no. But we do have ways that we can see what's going to happen. Now, I'm going to show you another way. Now, this is a little bit mathematically more complicated, and I try to break it down to where you can do it fairly quickly. But let me show you something. And I really do have to bring up that site that I was on. It just irritates me to no end. I do bookmark things, and then, okay. Now, I'm going to ignore the current inverted yield curve, and I'm going to get here back to when things were a little more normal. Let me take you to the beginning of 2022. Okay, as you can see, this is a normal, healthy yield curve. Now, one thing I will point out, though, is that this would be a healthy yield curve. If it arches up too much, that could mean that the markets are expecting an inflation down the road some years. In other words, that arching is being caused by pi e that they expect for a future time. So you worry if it gets too steep. But of course, then the other one is that abominable inverted yield curve. That's the one that would be a recession. Okay? So looking at the beginning of the year, That was actually a fairly healthy looking yield curve. It arched upward, but it didn't spike. I didn't see things going way up to the 3, 4, 5% range in this area right here, longer maturity instruments. Now, one thing about these yield curves is that a one-year yield curve, that is the annual and the annualized one-year yield. But when you get up to the two-year, that's actually a composite. That's the average of 2 years. The three-year is the average of 3 years. It doesn't tell you what happened in the third year. It's telling you what the overall was for years 1, 2, and 3. What we might be interested in is, see, this 1 year was 0.4% and the 2 year was 0.78%. We might be interested in saying, well, what was the one from 1 to 2 years that made the 2 year 0.78% and the 1 year 0.4%? In other words, the 2 year is actually a 1 year, 0 to 1, and multiplied by a 1 to 2. Together, they created that 2 year that we see, the 0.78. What if we could tease out the 1 to 2? That would tell us what the markets are expecting in 1 year to 2 years, instead of just a composite of 1 and 2 years together. And I'll use numbers that are a little bit, these are all weird numbers anyway. But suppose that I said, okay, suppose that I said that the 1 year is 1.15% and the 2 year is 1.25%. Now, I'm not going to do this. I could do this for some really long periods and it'll kill you. I mean, it's easier to do this in Excel, quite honestly, than by manually. But I'm going to pull up a calculator here, which I usually do at the beginning, and I forgot to. Okay, so this one, let me do it this way. The 1 year annualized, that's all that is, would be 1 plus 0.0115. Remember, in finance, the rates are always 1 plus. Mathematically, that's how we work. But that 2 year is actually 1 plus R sub 1. Times 1 plus R sub 2. And together, let me put 1, 2 on that R to say that's a 1 to 2 year rate. And together, those are making 1 plus R sub 2 squared, which in this case is 1 plus 0.1125. Squared. Just ride with me. Ride with me. And I'll do another one of these just so you can get the hang of it. But I know the 1 plus R sub 1, that's 1 plus 0.0115 plus 1, the rate. So 1 plus 0.0115 times 1 plus the R sub 1 to 2 comes out to what we see as 1.25%. That R sub 1 comma 2 is what we call a forward rate, or a forward. You'll hear me use the term forward. It tells us the conditions that the market is expecting just from year one to year two, instead of a composite of year one and year one to two, which we see in the market. But the market is hiding something under here. Now let me solve this one for you. 1 plus R sub 1, 2 would be equal to 1 plus 0.0125 divided by 1 plus 0.0115. Oh, 1.5 squared. So in other words, R sub 1, 2, the forward rate from year 1 to year 2 is going to be 1.0125 squared over 1.0115 minus 1. Now I understand this can kind of fog your mind for a little bit. I'll do another one and I'll show you how it works. Again, clear. So I'm going to take 1.0125 squared, and I'm going to divide it by 1.0115 minus 1, 1.35. That's the 1 to 2 year forward. Notice that the markets are actually expecting time period from year one to year two to have a higher interest rate than either of those. So in other words, we are going to still see that at least the markets expect that next year interest rates will be a little higher than they are right now. That's what that's telling us. Now I'm going to take you on a little bit of a journey here. You can do this for years 2 to 3. Watch this. Suppose that I know that year 3, what I see there on that treasury year yield curve is I see 1.18%. In other words, there's an inversion on 2 to 3. Well, now I know that 1 plus 0.0115 times 1 plus 0.0135 times 1 plus the forward 2 to 3 is going to be equal to 1 plus 0.0118 cubed. Each yield you see is a composite. It's a composite of a chain of forward rates. For year two is actually a composite of 1 to 2. Year 3 is a composite of year 1, year 2, and year 3. Well, as I've solved for year, I know year one because that's the one that's actual. Year two composite, I've broken that down, so the 1 to 2. So in other words, 1 plus R sub 1 times 1 plus R sub 1, 2 times 1 plus R sub 2, 3 equals that right there. So now I can solve it rather painfully, I might add. So R sub 2, 3 would equal 1.0118 cubed over 1.0115 times 1.0135 minus 1. Now, this should, if you get this the first time, you're better than I was the first time, couple of times I saw this trick. Like I said, this is Excel territory. It's a lot easier to do this in Excel. What did I do there? 1.0118 cubed. 1.0118 to the third power divided by, open parentheses, 1.0115 times, whoops, no, I don't need that parenthesis there, times 1.0135, close the parentheses, minus 1. So in year 3, from year 2 to 3, we should see interest rates sag back down to 1.04%. What was that? 1.0104. So in other words, that one, R sub 2, 3, is 1.04%. Okay? Like that. So we can actually see, it's not obviously perfect, but it's what the market is saying to us. On the surface, all we see is the yield curve. But we know that those yields on these instruments out here are composites. And so we can tease out the pieces of them. So I can see, for example, a very normal human being. But if I look and take the different sides of your brain, I see creativity, insanity, or something like that. I don't know. You know what I mean. But and here's the thing is, your homework gives you a couple problems, one or two problems. I think one problem like this. I won't ask this on a quiz or an exam. So I'm showing you this because the book does show it, and I do know that it can just fog your brain the first couple of times you see this. But interestingly enough, there are places where you can find, instead of the normal yield curve like this, you can see the forward yield curve, the 1 to 2, the 2 to 3, the 1, then the 1 to 2, the 2 to 3, the 3 to 4, and all that. You can actually see those forward rates. So, and they tell, interestingly enough, a more in-depth story than just, well, yeah, markets are right now saying that a 2-year is 1.25%. But what they're really saying is that right now we've got 1.15, and it will pop in years 1 to 2 to 1.35. That's why the 2-year comes out as a composite 1 to 1.25. So as long as the yield curve is rising, the forward rates will get larger. Do you see that? See how that yield curve rose there? And so the composite, so the forward was bigger than the first year and the second year. But notice when we drop back down, that will tell us that the year 2 to 3 had to be lower than the 2 in order for the 3 to be where it was. It's worth it for you to be able to just get it done for these problems. The basic idea is that for a 1 to 2 rate, you take the square of 1 plus the 2 rate divided by 1 plus the 1 rate. So in other words, putting it as a formula, which might help you, the R sub 1, 2, the forward 1 to 2, would be 1 plus the normal R sub 2 squared over the 1 plus R sub 1. Okay? Those would be the ones you'd see on the yield curve, those 2, 1. And so if you want to say the R sub 2, 3, that would be 1 plus the R sub 3 cubed over the 1 plus R sub 1 times the 1 plus R sub 1, 2. I think those two formulas will be enough. If you want to use those, you can get through that homework question. I don't think they're stupid enough to go out there to 5, 10. You can imagine what it's like, though, if you have to do one that's a forward 9 to 10 or something like that. Oh, then it gets to be a lot like work, because you're doing that chain of calculations. The R sub 10 would be 1 plus, the R sub 9, 10 would be 1 plus the R sub 10 to the 10th power over 1 plus R sub 1 times 1 plus R sub 1, 2 times 1 plus R sub 2, 3 times 1 plus R sub 3, 4. You get the picture. That's what you just punt and you decide that you're going to major in fine arts or something like that. But there's where that sits. I was going to tell you one other thing here. I think I've torn you up enough for today. That's all I have for you.